I'm Leela, and I'm here with my husband, Joshua. We got betrothed and married in 2012, and today we're going to be exploring the topic of initiating coming from the woman's side, and whether it's okay for her to let a guy know that she's interested. This is a something we hear a lot from the Christian community, and probably secular people talk about it too, but we're primarily talking to Christians on this podcast.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking about biblical betrothal, and mostly only Christians care.
Yeah, if you're new here, biblical betrothal is our topic, and today specifically we'll be exploring the book of Ruth and what we learn from it about women initiating when it comes to matrimony.
In the past, it's been a traditionally male initiation, and that's in the Western cultures, and that's something that was kind of pulled from various things in the Bible. And so some Christian segments of Christianity are against women initiating at all, and that they just need to sit back and wait. And then there's a pushback on that that will say that women should initiate, show they're interested. And there's even men that are saying, I want to know if she's interested before I, you know, stick my neck out, and that way I know that I'm not going to be rejected.
Yeah, he says, why should I have to be the one to, you know, make the first move? There's no rule in the Bible. You can't find a verse that says, thou shalt only allow thy women to wait for a man to initiate or anything like that. It is in there, I think, that men are supposed to initiate, but it's a little more, it's not a rule, and it's a little more vague than that. It's sort of a principle, I guess.
Yeah, you could say there's a principle. I mean, one of the major principles is that we look at Christ and the church as our example. That's what the picture that marriage is supposed to paint. That's the reason why we have, you know, betrothal as a picture of Christ and the church. And in that picture, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. He initiated. He sought us. We didn't, you know, say, hey, we're interested. He came directly to us and, you know, brought his offer of covenant to live with him to us. And so there is that principle. And that's why you would say, unless there's a reason to go outside of the principle, which we can talk about some of the reasons there might be for going outside the principle. Unless there's a reason to go outside the principle, sticking in the principle does make a lot of sense.
Yeah. Principle might be putting it a little too hard. It's more like a ideal might be a better way of putting it.
Yeah, you could say an ideal.
Because I would put principle as more like an actual right and wrong. Whereas I think when it comes to something like this, is like the ideal is, it's because I wouldn't say you were sinning if a woman initiated.
No, especially like I said, especially if you're getting into some of these areas where there's a reason for it. Mm-hmm. So calling it an ideal or a principle that has, you know, various exceptions to it, I think makes sense. I don't think we should get so hung up on that it can only happen a certain way that we lose track of the fact that what we're really after is seeking marriage according to the will of God. Mm-hmm. And as we'll see in the book of Ruth, sometimes it looks a little different than the standard, here's a guy who wants a wife and he goes seeking one.
Yeah. For sure, the average way it seems to happen, even when your culture doesn't even say that it has to happen that way, it just seems like normally the man is the driver in the driver's seat. You usually see the man pursuing the woman first. And I think that's just sort of built into our design, that women are more likely to wait and see what happens, and a man's more likely to take the risk of making something happen.
Men tend to be slightly bigger gamblers. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even in the design, the initiation, even all the way back to the creation of mankind, the man was, you know, naming the animals and did not find a helpmeet. So he was the one looking and not finding, and then God brought Eve. And I think that when we're ready to look, we should be looking to God to bring, not, you know, just acting on our own. He would have never found one if he had just, you know, stuck to his own devices. It had to be Yahweh bringing him his wife.
Any amount of looking wasn't going to make Eve show up.
No.
It is interesting that even in the garden, the pattern is sort of set of the man is the one that's seeking, and then the woman is found. That is interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I hadn't even thought of that before. So yeah, we see it all the way back then that God set up the pattern, which we know that marriage, the pattern of marriage was set up in Genesis.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that the whole pattern is there.
It does.
If you look. I mean, we do believe, at least Joshua and I believe, that the Bible is our guide for all things marriage. Yes. We try to make sure we don't make anything that is not found in the Bible a rule
right.
of any kind. Everything else is just, anything that's not in the Bible is, you. Some people would say Christian liberty. So you could be like, you can drive a car to get to your spouse's house.
You don't
house.
Have to use a camel.
We don't see that as a rule, even though that is in the Bible. But it's not a rule in the Bible. It's just something that was being done.
So you've got the commandments of God, which I think we need to take, you know, directly as they're stated. These are God's commandments. And then you have a statement by Paul writing to one of his trainees that all scripture is given by God and it's profitable for instruction in righteousness. And so even these examples in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, the early part of the New Testament, they're examples of how we can go about living our lives. And so whether we're reading about Isaac and Rebekah, Adam and Eve, like we just talked about, or the book of Ruth, like we're about to get into, what we can learn from these examples is that there's these principles, there's these little concepts and ideals that we can pick up from them and then practice them. Again, we're not saying, you know, everyone's going to have 10 camels full of goods to go look for a wife. We're talking about what can we learn that will make this apply to us.
Just because, yeah, Adam and Eve weren't wearing clothes doesn't mean that's the way we all do things now. You have to use a little bit of, I guess, discernment and wisdom and when we try to apply some of this stuff.
Right, that's why starting with the commandments makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. The main topic we're trying to cover is the whether or not women can initiate. And as we already kind of went into, it's not a rule that they can't.
It's not a rule,
but we think it's sort of the ideal that they should not.
Right. Ideally, we're doing a picture. You know, he first loved us. He sought us out. And sometimes that just can't work. Sometimes the woman's in a situation where she needs to get things rolling, because without that, she's going to be in trouble.
Extenuating circumstances.
Yep.
I am remembering reading an article where the man was pointing out that the way that the marriage gets started, like how it's initiated, is a setting yourself up for what's going to continue into your marriage. And so he was pointing out how, since if we really believe the man is supposed to be the head of the family,
mm-hmm.
the head of the wife, and whatever that entails, you know, mm-hmm. it seems to have some sort of a leadership aspect.
Yeah.
Then you should also expect him to go ahead and get into the habit by starting out the relationship as the leader, as the initiator. You could just call a husband an initiator.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times
the director.
That is what headship means, is the initiator, the driver.
So he was like, well, you should start off that way then in the relationship.
Yeah.
If you want that to be the pattern of your marriage.
Right, just like we want to start off relationship by seeking the Father's will so that that pattern continues in our marriage. We want to start off a relationship with being, with showing respect for each other so that that pattern continues mm-hmm. in the relationship. All these things, we want to start off with the right pattern. It makes it easier to continue in. Again, when we get into some of these things, there it's not always possible to start with the man initiating, but there's a lot of good that can come from the man initiating. One thing is that, personally speaking to men, if you're not ready to step forward and put that risk to say, I think this is what the Father's will is, I'm going to go ahead and step forward and see what happens. If you're not ready to do that much of putting yourself out there, of being the initiator, being basically the leader in that situation, of following Yahweh and doing what you think he's told you to do, you're probably not ready to be a husband. Because when you're a husband, it's not just you anymore, it's also a family that's going to be that you're going to need to be ready to walk in God's ways and lead them in God's ways. So if you're not ready to step forward and do this without, you know, making sure that everything's going to be okay, sometimes following Yahweh and going down the path that he calls you to do is just going to be awfully hard. And if you're not ready to do that, regardless of how hard it is, then you might not be ready to be a husband.
On the tail of what you were just saying about men, to the women, I would point out that if one of the major complaints women have about husbands a lot of times is that they're too passive. Mm. and that they're not doing, you know, anything for the family, they're not taking initiative, it sets up a bad pattern for the woman to be the initiator and then turn around later and go, well, he's so passive, but if he was passive at the beginning, what do you expect? Mm-hmm. So in some ways, think about your long term if you really want to initiate with someone.
Initiating is a way to get a passive man, yeah.
Yeah, it's basically...
It's not guaranteed it will work out that way, but that if you want a passive man, that's how you would get him.
And men can change, of course.
Yes.
And women can change, too. So, yeah, no matter what you have done, this is not a judgment on you.
No.
Like, too bad for you. You're never going to have a good marriage. We're just talking about ideals. As usual, on our channel, we try to talk about the ideal and what
the
pattern ideals in Scripture is that we're supposed to be aiming for.
Right. We want to always say it's never too late to turn around and follow God's ways. And God is such a merciful, compassionate God. He can take anything that we've done and turn it into good. He can use it. He can restore. He heals. The power that he has and the compassion that he has to take our mistakes, which is pretty much all we're capable of, and turn them into beautiful pictures and beautiful marriages is it's just incomprehensible. And so we're not trying to do any condemnation or anything. If you got and say, I did that wrong, we went into this marriage wrong, I was if you know, as a man, you're saying basically I went into this marriage passive, it's not too late to say, you know what, I need to get right with God, I need to repent from that, I need to move forward as the leader initiator to show the path to following God's ways. And it's not too late to do that. Okay. You can always step forward and say, we're going to work on this. We're going to fix this up and move forward in a righteous way.
Mm-hmm. The story we're going to be talking about from the Bible today is from the book of Ruth. And, I'm just going to skip over the beginning. The backstory for Ruth is that she's a widow from Moab. And what happened is she was married to an Israelite man who went to Moab during a famine. And so she ends up being in Moab a widow because he dies young, I guess. He didn't live very long. And so she and her mother-in-law travel back to Israel, his homeland. And there's a very nice story there of her choosing her mother-in-law to go and help her mother-in-law and be with her mother-in-law, even though she could have gone back to her father's house in Moab. But she wants to choose to be with the Israelites.
Yeah, if you're not familiar with the story of Ruth, definitely grab a Bible, read the book of Ruth. It's only a couple chapters long, it's short, but it's very sweet, and it's got a lot of neat stuff in
it. It's an easy read for a Bible story, I would say.
It's a pretty easy Bible read.
We're reading from the KJV here. I'm going to pick up in chapter 2. And Naomi, that's the mother-in-law, had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth, of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz. And spoiler alert, this is the hero of the story. And Ruth the Moabitess said unto Naomi, let me now go to the field and glean ears of corn after him in whose sight I shall find grace. And she said unto her, go, my daughter. So Naomi and Ruth are basically destitute. They don't have any money or anything. They have no man to help take care of them. They're in a pretty bad fix. So gleaning, you have to go around behind the workers in the fields that are harvesting the grain. And you have to pick up whatever you can find. So it's...
Yeah, and it's actually, if you go back, like we're talking about the commandments of God, it's actually a commandment in the Torah, in the rules that the Israelites received from God when they came out of Egypt, that you have to leave behind the droppings as you go through and harvest your field for the widow and the stranger, the fatherless, for the people that are going to be struggling to come through and pick up whatever they can find. That's the position Ruth is in. There are two widows because Ruth's father-in-law also died in Moab.
Yeah.
There's no more men in the family. There's just Naomi and Ruth. Mm-hmm. And here they are. They need sustenance, and Ruth is young. I guess it's because she's younger, probably more fit. That's why she's the one out there gleaning for their food.
So she's a foreigner out working. She happens to go to the field. It says she happens to go to the field of Boaz.
Right. She could have gone to any field because every Israelite is supposed to be leaving the gleanings. She ended up by coincidence, providence, in the field of Boaz.
Yeah, who is a distant relative of theirs. I think a cousin
Her
husband.
It's hard to tell exactly the relationship, but yeah.
Oh, it doesn't say exactly.
A relative, a kinsman that's pretty close in the line.
So Boaz shows up, the master of the field. He wasn't working there. He shows up and it says, then said Boaz unto his servant that was set over the reapers, whose damsel is this? Talking about Ruth. Who's that girl? Mm-hmm. And the servant that was set over the reapers answered and said, it is the Moabitish damsel that came back with Naomi out of the country of Moab. And she said, I pray you let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. So she came and hath continued even from the morning until now, that she tarried a little in the house. So Boaz tells Ruth to go ahead and work here in his field, and he's really nice to her and tells all the other workers to leave her alone.
Yeah, he actually gives her her meal at lunchtime when they're taking their break from the field, which is beyond what he's required to do by law, by the Torah law, and even tells his reapers, drop stuff on purpose for her. He's actually going to make her gathering of her food easier. Mm-hmm. And all he knows about her is that she's, you know, come from a far country, that she's a foreigner. So he's following the statutes to remember the poor, remember the foreigner and the underprivileged, and take care of them. So you can see right off from here that Boaz has a good character and that he's actually, you know, following Yahweh's commandments.
He's a generous,
yeah,
kind generous man, kind. Yeah. He tells her how to get water, and then it says, and then she fell on her face and bowed herself to the ground and said unto him, why have I found grace in thine eyes that thou shouldest take knowledge in me, seeing I am a stranger? And Boaz answered and said unto her, it hath fully been showed me all that thou hast done unto thy mother-in-law since the death of thine husband, and how thou hast left thy father and thy mother in the land of thy nativity, and art come into a place which thou knewest not heretofore.
In modern English, she's come, Boaz has heard that she's been taken care of her mother-in-law, that she left her home country, and, you know, all that she knew in order to come and serve her mother-in-law, and now she's, you know, basically being the provider for her mother-in-law. And so Boaz has heard this, and so he knows that she also has been doing her best to be a person of character.
Mm-hmm. So
he knows her by reputation. That's one way of putting it.
He wants to reward her for being a good daughter-in-law. Then she said, let me find favor in thy sight, my lord, for that thou hast comforted me, and for that thou hast spoken friendly unto thine handmaid, though I be not like unto thine handmaidens. She's probably quite unusual.
Yeah, she keeps mentioning how she's a stranger. And again, if you're coming into a foreign country, especially in the days when travel was less common, this is significant. She doesn't feel like she belongs here.
No, she's probably quite different from the Israelite girls. Mm-hmm. And so then, like Joshua was saying, Boaz takes care of her and makes sure she has lunch.
He tells her to stay in his fields to glean throughout the whole season. And he's, you know, given his young men command to make sure she stays protected.
So she ends up back at home with Naomi with extra food than you would expect from just picking up leftovers.
Yeah.
And her mother-in-law said unto her, where hast thou gleaned today? And where wroughtest thou? Blessed be he that did take knowledge of thee. And she showed her mother-in-law with whom she had wrought. And she said, the man's name with whom I wrought today is Boaz. And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, blessed be he of the Yahweh who hath not left off his kindness to the living and to the dead. And Naomi said unto her, the man is near of kin to us, one of our next kinsmen. So Naomi apparently knows that this guy is a relative.
Right.
And she's pretty excited about how much favor she's gotten from this person.
And so then they go through several months of the harvest season where Ruth is out there getting her
gleans. I think I looked it up and it was about 3 months.
Yeah, it would be about 3 months, because the beginning of harvest to when you're getting into the wheat harvest is about 3 months.
She just sticks with the gleaning in Boaz's fields for their survival. All right, then finally in chapter 3, the plot thickens, and Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, shall I not seek rest for thee, that it may be well with thee? And now is not Boaz of our kindred, with whose maidens thou wast? Behold, he winnoweth barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash thyself, therefore, and anoint thee, and put thy raiment upon thee, and get thee down to the floor, but make not thyself known unto the man until he shall have done eating and drinking. So Naomi's cooked up a little plot here. Finding rest, she's saying, I want to get you married. Oh.
Yeah, you can see that if you read in chapter 1, which we kind of skipped through. One of the things why Naomi told her two daughter-in-laws, there were two that started at the beginning of the story, told both of them to go back to their families, is because she's not going to have any more sons. She's not going to be able to provide husbands to them to find rest. Ruth says she's coming anyway. The other daughter-in-law actually goes back to Moab and does not follow.
So Naomi knows that Ruth, you know, it's a miserable existence to be a poor widow the rest of your life. She wants to find a husband for Ruth. And Boaz being a relative, this is a little strange to our thought, but that actually made him the person to pick.
Right. Now, he's not Ruth's relative. He's a relative of Naomi's husband's family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how relatives are counted in the scriptures, is according to the male line on that side.
We'll get into that in a little bit, but that actually makes Naomi more interested in getting Ruth married to him. But anyway, she's got this little plan. She tells Ruth to get all prettied up and go down to where Boaz is working on the grain, getting it finished up to put into the...
Put it into storage for the winter.
The storage, yeah. And it shall be, when he lieth down, that thou shalt mark the place where he shall lie, shall watch and see. And thou shalt go in and uncover his feet, and lay thee down, and he will tell thee what thou shalt do. And she said unto her, all that thou sayest unto me, I will do. Ruth, I'm speechless. Okay. Naomi has this plan where she's going to go and take the blanket off his feet and lay down at his feet while he's asleep. And Ruth is going to let Boaz take it from there, is what Naomi says you need to do. And Ruth says she's going to do it. So this is not two people that are in love, I don't think, by the way. They haven't had all that much contact besides that really nice little conversation.
Yeah.
Where he tells her how he wants to take care of her, make sure she's okay.
Yeah, as far as we know, that's the only conversation they had. It's the only one recorded during those, that was 3 months earlier.
And Boaz doesn't seem like he works in the fields. He came to check on it.
Yeah, he comes out and checks every now and then, probably, and he's going to be at the threshing because it's an important aspect of his harvest happening. He's definitely a wealthy man because he's got multiple young men and an overseer over his young men. So he's even got like a steward set up, which means he's probably got a lot of stuff going on.
Well, it sounds like they're having basically a harvest party because she says he's going to be eating and drinking, mm-hmm. and then they're all going to sleep there. I've heard somebody make a theory that they're sleeping there to guard it because they have all their grain sitting there and somebody could easily come and rob it. So he's going to spend the night with the grain, basically.
Yeah, there are places where it talks about robbing the threshing floors mm-hmm. and other passages in the scripture.
She gets herself all pretty and goes and does exactly like Naomi says and uncovers his feet and lays her down. And it came to pass at midnight that the man was afraid and turned himself, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. Wow. And he said, who art thou? And she answered, I am Ruth, thine handmaid. Spread therefore thy skirt over thine handmaid, for thou art a near kinsman.
Okay, so now this part actually needs a little bit of explanation, and we actually have to go back to the law, the Israelite law from God in Deuteronomy chapter 25. And it actually says, if brethren dwell together, and one of them die and has no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife, perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. So you've got this setup where if a woman marries into a family and doesn't have a child, that if her husband dies, the brother in that family is supposed to marry her. And we actually see that this is, in Ruth, they're extending this idea not just to a sibling brother, but also to a kinsman, the next closest kinsman, because a brother would be considered the closest kinsman. And so the next closest kinsman has this responsibility to marry her. For one thing, that keeps her from being a widow. It keeps her from falling into this difficult state where she's going to have to glean and be right on the edge of sustenance. And for another, it allows her to have children to build up her former husband's family. It actually says that the seed would count for that first man in the case of a brother.
So his child, her and his first child would be called her dead husband's
child. It would be called her dead husband's child. And again, it says that in the case of a brother. It doesn't specify in the Torah that we're going to go to the next nearest relative, and it doesn't specify that in that case the son is counted as the previous. But it does seem like they're saying this is a common thing, that the nearest kinsman does have this responsibility. And there's actually another aspect of that, which is the inheritance of the land, which we'll actually talk about. It actually talks about a little bit further.
When she says to spread your skirt over me, that is basically saying I want to become part of your family, be under your protection. Because like some places it's translated, it's more like your wing or your the man's shawl, basically. I'll take you in under my outfit, basically. It's another kind of poetic way to get married. Say, would you marry me, please?
And so she's kind of claiming
the right.
She's claiming the right that she has as the widow from this family. You're the near kinsman. Marry me. And the way most people read it is that this is a right of this widow in this family to demand covering in marriage from the nearest relative.
Yeah, the Torah actually says the way to do it is she needs to...
If he's trying to say no, she can actually take a case to the judges and basically, say, this guy needs to do his duty.
Mm-hmm. And if he doesn't, he gets publicly shamed.
He's publicly shamed. One of the ways that he's publicly shamed is that his shoe is taken away.
Mm-hmm. Which we are going to see a little bit more about that in this story. Boaz said, blessed be thou of Yahweh, my daughter, for thou hast showed more kindness in the latter end than at the beginning, inasmuch as thou followedest not young men, whether poor or rich.
So he's saying, you didn't go after the young men. You didn't go after the, you know, whether they're rich or poor, you're not going after the young men. You're just doing the exact, you know, you're basically staying in the guidelines of the law. So he again sees her doing what's right.
Yeah, and he calls her daughter and is surprised she doesn't go after the young men. So again, don't take any kind of a Hollywood story out of your mind of this is some gorgeous hunk. In that, you know, they are not at all close in age, and Boaz was not expecting this. So there was no prior romance going on.
Yeah, he's surprised, and he's calling her daughter, and he's talking about young men that he would have thought she would have gone for. So, yeah, there's an age gap here. Doesn't tell us what that age gap is, but we can surmise that it's going to be, well, if he's calling her daughter, you know, usually you can't.
They're not going to have a child. I would think.
We're guessing 15 to 20 years, but yeah, there's definitely an age gap here.
I think a 10-year gap, you could start feeling like the other person's a kid compared to you.
Yeah, maybe.
So the at minimum, you know, maybe she's 20 and he's 30, but it's probably a lot more than that. Traditionally, I know the Jews think that he was much older, but
yeah.
I don't put a lot of weight on what tradition is. So he says, "And now, my daughter, fear not, I will do to thee all that thou requirest, for all the city of my people know that thou art a virtuous woman."
So he says, your reputation, everyone knows you're a virtuous woman, I'll do it. You know, I'll follow the law, I accept your demand. Well, not, I mean, it's kind of a demand,
yeah.
But yeah, but I accept your proposal here
mm-hmm.
for marriage. Basically, and it's a nice way of putting it, is that I'd be glad to marry you.
Yeah,
you're a nice lady. You're a good woman.
Yeah, you're a good woman. And now it is true that I am thy near kinsman. Howbeit, there is a kinsman nearer than I. Tarry this night, and it shall be in the morning, that if he will perform unto thee the part of a kinsman, well, let him do the kinsman's part. But if he will not do the part of a kinsman to thee, then will I do the part of a kinsman to thee. As Yahweh liveth, lie down until the morning.
Yeah, so Boaz knows the family lineage better than apparently Naomi did, which would make sense because she just married into the family. And says there's actually a closer relative. So again, that statute from the Torah comes into play here that really he has the first responsibility. This other man that's mentioned here has the first responsibility to marry Ruth.
So it's another part of the interesting romance we have going here. Boaz is like, I'd be happy to marry you. And he goes, but there's another guy who probably has to marry you. So, you know, I'm just going to pass you on to him. Unless he doesn't want to, then I'll do it. So, and she lay at his feet until the morning. And she rose up before one could know another. And he said, let it not be known that a woman came into the floor. I don't think that they had any kind of physical intimacy here.
Yeah.
I mean, it can be confusing because sometimes in the Bible when it says that they lay down or together or whatever, they did a lot more than just lie there.
Yeah, considering Boaz's character and the fact that he is saying this other man is probably going to need to do the duty, there, you know, there's no reason at all to read that into the text.
I don't think there was any actual scandal. He did say don't let anybody know because it could turn into a scandal just because people will talk, you know.
Right.
But I don't think there was an actual scandal.
That's a matter of discretion there, I think, not like a
cover-up.
Not trying to get away with something. It's just a matter of discretion.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many lessons to be learned from this story, but that would be one of them. If you do have to watch out for your reputation, even if you know you're being good, she knows we're being good, everybody's behaving themselves, but does everybody else understand that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, be careful about that.
When it's all above board, even then sometimes it needs to be quietly done.
Mm-hmm. So he sends her back to Naomi with a whole bunch of grain as a gift and probably just, you know, so she won't starve. You don't send a girl home empty when you have a huge stack of grain behind you. But she takes her big bag of grain home and she comes and tells Naomi all about what happened. Then Naomi said, sit still, my daughter, until thou know how the matter will fall, for the man will not be in rest until he have finished the thing this day. So she knows Boaz is just going to go out and get this taken care of. He's not going to leave them hanging for months.
Which is another nice principle to think about in a betrothal. If you're leaving the other person hanging for months, it's not considerate.
No. Go as fast as you can.
Right. Sometimes it takes time to understand what you should do in a situation. And if it's truly taking time and you're not just dragging your feet, then, you know, you have to take the time to find out what the father's will is. But if you're just dragging your feet because of whatever reason, because you don't want to say the no, or you're reluctant to give the yes, it's not being considerate to the other person. And Boaz here, Naomi's confident this man is going to do the most considerate thing he can do, and he's going to get out there and get it done so that Ruth is not left hanging on who she's going
to
marry.
This is going to be part one of talking about Ruth and whether or not a woman should initiate, because it turned into a much bigger topic than we initially thought it would be. So it's going to be a two-part episode. So be sure to check out the second part